From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature one of our most requested recent interviews. Former white supremacist Floyd Cochran tells us about life inside a hate group. Cochran used to be national spokesperson and recruiter for the Aryan Nation. Now he's speaking out against the racist ideology he used to promote. That's coming up on this archive edition of Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. After meeting separately with Bosnian Serbs and the Muslim-led Bosnian government, a new group of international mediators has left Sarajevo. U.S. Envoy Charles Redman says the group was merely on a get-acquainted tour, laying the groundwork for face-to-face talks. Peter Green reports from Sarajevo.
The Serbs want a permanent ceasefire patrolled by U.N. troops. This would effectively define the borders of Greater Serbia. The Muslims want a 2 to 3 month truce before discussing a permanent ceasefire and a give back of land by the Serbs. The Muslims also say they will not begin talks until they are assured all the Serb heavy weapons are pulled back from Garajda. NATO is still checking its aerial photos. The negotiators' biggest handicap has been the failure of the outside world to halt the Serbian attack on Garajda. After the debacle there, the Bosnian Muslims are in no mood to trust the UN or any other mediators. And after allowing the Bosnian Serbs to press their offensive pretty much any way they liked, the mediators are unlikely to get many concessions from the Serbs. For National Public Radio, I'm Peter Green in Sarajevo.
In South Africa, voting officially has ended in the nation's first democratic elections, although officials at polling stations in some former black homelands have the authority to keep the polls open a while longer. Those stations had been turning voters away during the past couple of days because they hadn't been given enough ballots. Ballots finally were delivered by military helicopters. Officials ordered today's extra day of voting to allow those who were not accommodated before to cast ballots. Ford Motor Company says it made $904 million in the first 3 months of this year, and that's more than the number two automaker made in all of 1993. Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
A surge in new vehicle sales helped Ford boost its first quarter earnings by nearly 60% when compared to the same period of a year ago. The automaker's profits amount to $1.66 per share. Ford officials say their earnings would have been even higher, but the company took a $400 million charge relating to the sale of its first nationwide bank subsidiary. Auto analysts note that the industry is in the midst of a strong recovery, consumer confidence is up, and car buyers who delayed purchasing a new vehicle during the recession are now heading to the showrooms. Ford is the last of the domestic automakers to release its first quarter financial report. Yesterday, GM said it earned $854 million, while Chrysler's profit for the period totaled $938 million. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
The Treasury Department says it's taking action to support the value of the dollar, which has been approaching a record low against the Japanese yen. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 15 points at 3682.88 in heavy trading. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq Composite Index is up a point and a half. This is NPR. The government says sales of new homes jumped more than 11% in March with the retreat of winter weather. The increase is the largest in 6 months. Sales rose in all regions except the Midwest. The Northeast did especially well, with sales surging by 38%. Analysts had expected big sales in March because so many buyers held back during the bad weather. The median price of a new home in March was $130,000. The median is the midpoint of all sale prices, half of the homes sold for more and half for less. The Israeli finance minister and his PLO counterpart have signed an agreement covering the economic relations between Israel and the future self-governing territories. The accord involves compromises by both sides. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
The deal gives the Palestinians some trappings of autonomy. They'll be able to set their own taxes and customs duties, though they've agreed to maintain roughly the same import policies as Israel. They'll also have responsibility over banking, but they will not have their own currency. The agreement gives the Palestinians the right to work in Israel and allows for the free movement of goods between the two sides, though Israel is maintaining import quotas on certain agricultural products from the occupied territories for 5 years. The deal will initially apply to Jericho and the Gaza Strip, but eventually it will cover all of the occupied territories when they become self-governing. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Pope John Paul is recovering from surgery to repair a broken leg. The surgeon says he used an artificial device to replace the top of the femur bone in the Pope's right thigh. He says John Paul will not limp, but he will have to give up two of his favorite activities, skiing and mountain climbing. The Pope is 73 years old, but the surgeon says even if he were 20 years younger, the advice would be the same. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we're featuring one of our most requested recent interviews. Floyd Cochran is a former white supremacist. A self-described Hitler fanatic, he stayed on the fringes of white supremacy for close to 20 years. Then in 1990, after a divorce, he moved to the Idaho compound of the racist anti-Semitic group Aryan Nation. He rose in the group and became a national spokesperson and recruiter. In 1992, he organized the Aryan Nation's Youth Fest. But later that year, he left the white supremacist movement. Now he's speaking against hate groups, sharing his inside knowledge about how white supremacist groups operate. Last month, I asked him why, as a longtime neo-Nazi, he decided to leave Aryan Nation. He told me about the turning point.
I had been told by the leadership, the people above me at Aryan Nations, when they found out that my son was born with a cleft palate and a cleft lip, that he was a genetic defect, and that he would have to be euthanized, which is a polite word for murdered or killed, because he was a genetic defect. Now, I don't want to tell you, Terry, or the listeners, that in that very instance, I stopped being a racist. It took me 2 months from that point to build up the courage to leave the compound and also to examine, is this what I want to do? You know, but I couldn't get beyond that stumbling block.
What were there other things that were giving you doubts about Aryan Nation?
Not serious doubts. I mean, there was days, like any other individual, when be at work, be at play, be at whatever, you have those doubts. But they don't stay very long because they're fleeting or whatever. So I never seriously questioned what I was doing. I never seriously doubted what I was doing. But after that was said about my son and I had time to reflect, think, examine how I felt, I couldn't get past that wall that what was said about my son was wrong, but then how was it all right for me to say the same thing about people who were born different than I was because of their skin color, because of their faith, without being hypocritical? You know? And again, I don't want to convey to the listeners that getting over racist ideas and political thoughts and organized racism is something that a person does in 48 hours or 24 hours. It's been a year and a half now, and I still struggle with racist ideas. I still struggle with sexism. But unlike what I was doing in the past, I confront it. I confront it by the people that I associate with today. I confront it internally, not hiding behind something.
The group that you were a member of and national spokesperson for was Aryan Nation. What separates Aryan Nation from other organized racist groups? What's their focus?
Well, other than, for instance, the Klan wears a white sheet, and at Aryan Nations I wore a blue shirt. There's really no difference. Both are becoming part of the Christian identity network. And it's the Christian identity that people in this country really need to start concerning themselves with.
The Christian identity is the name of a religious movement.
Right. It is the religion that the racists have developed. It gave me a higher justification for my hatred. It also imbued me and other people to go out and commit crimes in the name of God. If people would like to think, well, this is just an offbeat religion, we don't have to worry about it, this is a religion that teaches that white people are the sons of God and that it is their duty to exterminate Jewish people and people of color. And again, it's more than just sitting around and talking about these things and reading the Bible. I'll point out that since 1982, 20 people have been shot and killed because of Christian identity believers. Numerous crimes have happened, armored car robberies, the shooting death of Alan Berg, the Jewish talk show host, bombings of synagogues, churches, Catholic priests, attempted bombings of NAACP buildings, shootouts with law enforcement officials, These are all the things that are associated with Christian identity.
How large would you say the Christian identity movement is?
About 60,000 people.
Mm-hmm. Is there a founder of that movement?
Well, there would be many people who would be considered a founder. Dr. Swift, a former Ku Klux Klan rifle instructor who is now dead, would pretty much is considered a founder. Christian identity, like any other religion, organized religion, has its two separate factions. Both factions teach racism. It's just how they approach that racism. One faction teaches that God created everybody, but the biblical commandments and the Bible are for white people and white people only, and God will deal with his enemies when he returns. Two Seed Line Christian identity teaches that as a white person, you are commanded to go out and to kill Jewish people and black people today, here on earth and in the heavens. Also, Two Seed Line Christian identity teaches that Adolf Hitler was a biblical prophet of God. I mean, I would use the Bible to show that Hitler was a biblical prophet. You will find swastikas. You will find all the neo-Nazi paraphernalia that is associated with Nazism at Christian identity compounds.
This segment of Christian identity that preaches killing Jews and people of color, you call this the two-seed line. What does two-seed mean?
Well, it comes from the biblical passage in the Bible of Genesis 3:15, where God told Adam that I will put enmity between your seed and my seed, your seed being the seed of man. To fully explain, I'd have to back up a little bit and almost give you the identity doctrine. But identity teaches that Eve, instead of eating an apple, that she had sex with Satan, that was the forbidden fruit. And as a result, produced Cain, and Cain is considered the father of all Jews. Satan, we'll say the grandfather or whatever, using selective biblical passages to reinforce them.
So that would make all Jews the children of Satan?
Yes, and that is what it is taught at Christian identity compounds around the country and at churches. There are 300 identity churches in the country. There's an identity college in Grants Pass, Oregon. There are numerous compounds, Pennsylvania, Utah, Idaho, Oklahoma.
I think the goal of Aryan Nation is to create a separate nation.
Yes, we would take that as, it's called a territorial imperative. And you want to take the five states of the Pacific Northwest and turn them into an all-white country as a starting point. It certainly was not the cure-all or that was the final answer or whatever. The final answer is closer equated to the final solution that was implemented in Nazi Germany, and that was exterminating people based on their race, based on their faith, based on if they were genetic defects or not.
You had no problem when you were a member with the idea of exterminating people?
No. At Aryan Nations, you can purchase literature that denies the Holocaust, but you can also purchase materials that prove or show for the Aryans anyway that Hitler was just doing God's work.
Must take a remarkable lack of empathy to think that extermination would be okay, and that some people aren't really people.
Yeah, there's the whole crux is when you no longer consider someone to be a person, then that person is viable or open to any type of humiliation and or death. The other thing is when you are having constant Bible indoctrinations that to go out and kill people is the thing to do or is done in the name of God. I mean, I can think of a Bible verse that was used repeatedly to justify killing.
What was that?
It's in the book of Jeremiah, the Old Testament book of Jeremiah. I believe it's chapter 50, verse 21. And it's, "Thou art thy battle axe and weapons of war, and with thee we will break into pieces the nations and the kingdom of the world." So there again was that biblical justification. In Luke, it says, if you do not own a sword, sell your cloak and buy one. Well, today, that is an M16. So again, there is biblical justification to hate people. You can hate anyone. Down through the ages, we've used the Bible to justify our hatred and to advance a social agenda.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Floyd Cochran. He's a former national spokesman and youth recruiter of the white supremacist group Aryan Nation. He left that group about a year and a half ago and is now speaking nationally against organized hate and racist groups. What inspired you to actually move to the Aryan Nation compound?
A bunch of events kind of came together. The fact that in 1989 I became divorced, so that I'm no longer married. I have children, but they're with my ex-wife. The reason I picked Aryan Nations, let's say, versus the Klan, was the fact that Aryan Nations owned a piece of property.
Mm-hmm.
They had a definitive idea about the borders. that we were going to build this country, and mom was going to stay home, and dad was going to work, and there was going to be small farms and businesses. For a person who was very unstable in your own personal life, here is stability. You know? I grew up in foster homes all over the state of New York. Here was something very stable. I had a failed marriage. Here was something very stable. So not only with myself, but with lots of young people, that is an attraction. And within the racist movement, that has not gone unnoticed among the younger people, that that is a propaganda technique. That is a tool to recruit other young people.
Creating a family for them and selling them the
family,
idea of belonging.
Giving you self-esteem, giving you a uniform, giving you a title, giving you God.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very powerful inducement, especially when you're 18 years old.
Can you describe something about what the compound is like and what living there is like?
Well, the compound I lived on in North Idaho is the national headquarters for area nations. And it was that particular compound was 20 acres of land. It had a bunkhouse, had a guard tower, had a guard shack. It does have a place of worship. There is showers, facilities, things of that nature, places for people that bring their tents and their camping equipment and things.
Do you live in a tent?
I had a small camper at the time. Because I was an officer, it was allotted to me. In the spring is the annual Hitler Youth Festival, so upwards of 150 young people would show up from around the country and Canada to be indoctrinated, to learn how to hate people based on the Bible, to practice martial arts training. The women would have separate courses in child rearing. I think an area that we haven't covered that I would very much like to cover, and it's a relatively new area of the racist movement, very few people have taken a look at it, and that is the number of young women entering the racist movement today in record numbers.
Why is that?
In the past, women would join with their husbands or with their boyfriends. Today, the women are not only joining, but some of them have even formed their own organizations, Aryan Women's League, for instance. Oh, lots of reasons. I noticed that the overwhelming majority of these women came from single-parent homes where there was a lack of authority or structure, and that plays a big role in the developing of a young person. The other was pushing those buttons. When I would go and talk with people, when I would go and try to recruit people, if it was a young lady, I would talk about in an Aryan society, a man will take care of his children. And if you're a single mom, that's a powerful thing. In an Aryan society, dad's going to work and you're going to be put on a pedestal and things. There are still millions of people who have that traditional idea of mom and dad. The Aryans have just added the racial context to it. That's something we have to start examining because women, by their very nature and very fact, bring stability and infrastructure to the racist movement that it never had before. Infrastructure, the women have developed programs to, if a white supremacist is arrested, the women send clothes and birthday cards and money to the kids. They take up that collection. The women are in much more contact with one another from various organizations than the men are. Women are a great recruiting technique. I would use attractive women to stand in front of the camera because, again, it's a great recruiting technique. Also, women...
Recruiting for men and women.
And women, right.
Yeah, because for men it become a way to, meet chicks or something.
Yeah, yeah. Well, much like we sell cars with women. I mean, is there any correlation between a woman in a bikini and a new car? I mean, other than the fact that the woman in the bikini helps sell the car a little bit faster.
Mm-hmm.
So again, in terms of selling and propaganda techniques, it's still the same.
I'm wondering if there was an initiation that you had to go through.
Well,
or if your loyalty was tested in any way before you were allowed to live there.
In various, well, not so much in as far as being allowed to live there. First of all, because of the paranoia throughout the racist movement, everyone was watching you all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't matter how long you'd been there. People were always watching you. The other thing was your loyalty wasn't tested so much like you say as you do this and this will prove that you're loyal. What was tested more was your mettle, M-E-T-T-L-E. I was given different jobs to do and then watched to see how well I handled it.
Like what?
And at first it was as simple as mowing the lawn and chopping wood.
Mm-hmm.
Then it was doing guard duty. And then it was being put in charge of people who were mowing the lawn and chopping wood. And then at the first time that Idaho celebrated Dr. King's holiday in January of 1991, I was put in charge of 7 skinheads to go down and attend the Martin Luther King celebrations. And that turned out, as far as the Aryans were concerned, so well that I was appointed the propagandist.
Now, what was so successful about
well,
that?
Well, I'm still trying to debate, as other than the fact that we walked into the place and sat down, and it totally disrupted everything. They wouldn't let the people out of the room when we left. The next day when I picked up the newspaper, out of 14 paragraphs covering Dr. King's holiday, we had 11 of them. Just the fact that showing up there, and I kept everything, the people that were with me under control and so forth, and got very favorable press. Favorable press in that the newspapers reported I was personable, that I was educated, that I was kind of fun to be around. Those type of things gave me all kinds of credibility within the community.
Was all press seen as good press because it was a sign of your power if you were written about?
For myself, it was. Instinctively, most racists will refer to the press as being Jewish-controlled and approach it very hostile. Being a person who was raised on television and watching people sell whatever it was they wanted to sell on TV and the radio, I realized that the camera has replaced the pen as being which one is the mightier. That if I smiled and I gave reporters coffee and donuts when they come to visit, and I asked them about their family, that they were, one, much more relaxed around me. Their questions weren't quite so hard. And what they didn't realize was I had spent hours rehearsing in front of a camera over and over again. And that in two interviews, I realized that reporters are going to ask basically the same 25 questions. So the responses would seem to be spontaneous. And again, I went from milking cows in upstate New York. And then in 1991, I'm in Newsweek magazine because I was a pretty good spokesman. I didn't allow myself to be trapped into a situation. I didn't shout racial epithets. And I came across as the appearance of a reasonable person.
My guest is Floyd Cochran, a former spokesperson and recruiter for the white supremacist group Aryan Nation. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with former white supremacist Floyd Cochran. I want to talk with you more about your recruiting techniques. You were recruiting young people for Aryan Nation. You've told us a little bit about what you would do. What kind of language would you use? Would you go to, I don't know, a college campus or an area where there are young people and talk very explicitly about how Jews were the offspring of the devil and blacks are mud people? What language would you use?
It would all depend on the circumstances. For instance, I went to Oregon to talk about the spotted owl issue. Mm-hmm. On the surface, the spotted owl issue didn't appear to be a racial issue, but I made it one.
How?
By pointing out that this was just another example of a government set-aside program, setting aside the white logger in favor of a bird, another affirmative action program, another government set-aside program. And then from there, I had the whole field to myself. Lots of times, if I went into a community, first of all, I would hit the media, because media was my most successful ally I had in recruiting people. Even if it was bad media, it was still media nonetheless. The other was I would just sit and listen to young people. First of all, I wasn't interested in people over the age of 40. And people in the racist movement aren't interested in recruiting people over the age of 40.
Why not?
Well, first of all, you don't have that youthful ambition, that restfulness, that idealism. You're somewhat cynical. You have children. You're set in your ways. You've got a job, things of that nature. Also, it's not so easy to mold your mind when you're 40 years old. But a 14 to 25-year-old kid, you can do all kinds of things. And the racist movement has shown that in the last 20 years, the last 10 years. So again, I would sit and listen to what the young people had to say. Were they having problems at home? Were they having problems at school? And maybe work on that. If I noticed that it was more of a religious type thing, then I would pull out the Bible. Or I'd ask them, let's use your Bible, because Christian identity is a faith that uses the same Bible you'll find in any Protestant church. Not a Bible that the Aryans drew up or a Klansman. It's just the interpretation. When I went to Seattle, for instance, I went and looked at the demographics and saw that Seattle had a large gay and lesbian population, and that's just the targets I picked. When I was in California, it was illegal Mexicans. When I was in Tennessee, it was African Americans. So again, it required some studying on my part. From a propaganda point of view, anything that worked. Lots of times, I would use what I had perceived to be my enemies, their own words against them. For instance, the head of the Northwest Coalition Against Malicious Harassment had said that all racists were transparent. If you hold them up to the light, you could see that. I submitted an application to join the Human Rights Commission as a racist, and I used his very words. The Human Rights Commission talks about two sides of every issue, fairness and so forth, democracy. Well, we'll see if those are transparent words. You know, again, playing word games.
Now, how much would you talk explicitly about hate, about the about how blacks and Jews aren't human?
Once
in public settings, would you use those? Did you find kind of euphemisms to catch all that in?
I use euphemism, crime and welfare.
Mm-hmm.
I talk about crime and welfare. They own the media.
Without saying who they is?
Right. Until the person, if the person came back for a second visit, mm-hmm. then it was very explicit. But for an opening line or whatever, I would just try to be myself. If a young person showed a lot of interest and they came up to the compound, that person was made the focus of everything for 2 weeks. We would tell them that we love them.
Uh-huh.
We would give them hugs. You give them a uniform. You give them some responsibilities. The fact that I was an adult, even though that young people may not like to admit it, there's still that desire to please adults. I think the biggest thing, probably one of the most successful, was we're family. We work together and we play together. But I think what the young people need to know is that once they get arrested, the adult leadership disappears. And I can point to numerous incidences where young people have committed crimes thinking that they were going to please the adult leadership. And the adult leadership simply said, "We don't know you."
I want to get back to the language that you'd use when recruiting people. What are some of the other code words?
ZOG, which is Zionist, which is a euphemism in the racist movement for Zionist occupational government. The belief that the Jewish people control the government. Within Christian identity, not referring to God as, let's say, Jehovah, but referring to him as Yahweh. Again, it's a different word that people aren't used to. We would talk about crime and welfare. We talk about drugs a lot. And again, in more of a racial context. There are very few racists today who will stand on a street corner and say, "Let's go out and kill people." Because first of all, you can be put in jail for it. Second of all, realizing that propaganda effect, that doesn't work. And again, that's what makes the racist more dangerous, because they have realized these things and are becoming slicker. In public, I would tell people that I was a white separatist. Sounds much softer on the ears, much more palatable, conjures up different ideas. But on the compound, we dropped all of that. We talked explicitly about killing people. I sat in on a conversation talking about what to do when a dead body falls out of an oven. Do you pick it up, put it back in yourself, or do you go find someone to do it for you? I mean, those were the kind of conversations. We talked about hanging filthy, lying politicians and preachers. We talked about killing gay and lesbian people. But in public, no, with the exception of gay and lesbian people.
Was it easier to get away with that in public?
Oh, not only easier, society appreciated it, but I don't know, maybe appreciated isn't the right word. To give you an example, if I walked outside this door here in Philadelphia and I made anti-black remarks, I'd have to duck. The politicians would attack me, the clergy would attack me, people walking up and down the street would attack me. I could go out here and say homophobic remarks, and I would automatically have jumped into 35 to 40% of the population will agree with what I'm saying about gay and lesbian people.
Floyd Cochran is a former spokesperson and recruiter for the white supremacist group Aryan Nation. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Floyd Cochran will be back with us in the second part of our show.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Former white supremacist Floyd Cochran calls himself a self-taught racist. Coming up in part two of our interview, Cochran tells us how he became a racist, why he joined the Aryan Nation, and what his life has been like since he defected from the group. That's coming up on this archive edition of Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. An international delegation trying to revive the Bosnian peace process has met with Bosnian Serb leaders and with the Muslim-led government. Kathy Jenkins reports from Sarajevo.
A spokesman for the delegation, Charles Redmond, said a three-point agenda had been presented to the two sides. First, the situation in Gorizia had to be clarified and all agreements concerning it implemented. A ceasefire should be established throughout Bosnia. That, in turn, should be linked to an active negotiating process to find an overall settlement. Both the Bosnian Serbs and the Bosnian government have expressed a readiness to negotiate. A senior Bosnian Serb official said the Serbs were anxious that there should be progress. However, the Bosnian president, Ali Izetbegovic, has repeated that the Bosnians cannot negotiate until they are satisfied that the withdrawal of Serb troops around Gorizia has been completed. The first hurdle for the contact group will be to find agreement on the terms of a ceasefire. The Serbs want a permanent ceasefire, although they say they would accept a four-month cessation of hostilities.
Kathy Jenkins for the BBC. Election officials in South Africa formally have declared voting ended in the country's first all-race elections. But officials note that individual polling station organizers have the authority to keep the polls open longer if necessary. Counting of the ballots is scheduled to begin in the morning, with the first results available by the end of the day tomorrow. Officials in Denver may have to order another delay in opening the city's new airport. It would be the fourth postponement for the $4 billion facility. Ansel Martinez reports.
Denver city leaders, airline executives, and bond underwriters are meeting today to discuss what could be a fourth postponement in the opening date of Denver's new airport because of problems with the baggage system. The trouble-plagued system has not performed well in test runs this week. The system uses carts on rails to deliver thousands of bags of luggage, but suitcases are often misrouted. The private contractor concedes the high-tech system won't be ready for an airport opening date of May 15th. But the city must make millions of dollars of interest payments on bonds issued to finance the airport's construction, even if the airport isn't open. Denver Mayor Wellington Webb, however, says there won't be an official announcement today on a possible delay. For National Public Radio, I'm Ansel Martinez in Denver.
California filed suit against the federal government today, demanding reimbursement for the cost of jailing illegal immigrants. The state blames the federal government for not keeping illegal aliens out of the country. California is asking for $2 billion. Florida has filed a similar suit, and Arizona is planning to. On Wall Street, stock prices closed higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 13 points to close at 3681.69. Advances led declines by a margin of 3-2. This is NPR. Jurors have suspended their deliberations for the weekend in the case of Michigan suicide doctor Jack Kevorkian. They're considering whether to convict Kevorkian of assisting the suicide of Thomas Hyde, who suffered from Lou Gehrig's disease. Before recessing, the jurors asked the judge to give them a written copy of state law that allows a doctor to give a dying patient medicine to ease suffering, even if it will bring on death sooner. The defense says Kevorkian was easing Hyde's suffering, but the prosecution says he supplied him with carbon monoxide, which is a poison, not a medicine. Officials at the Vatican say Pope John Paul is in excellent condition after having surgery on a broken leg. Francis Kennedy reports from Rome.
The 73-year-old Pope underwent 2.5 hours of surgery today to mend a fractured right thigh bone. This involved doctors inserting a small prosthesis where the thigh joins the hip. The Vatican spokesman said the surgery was a complete success and that the Pope would remain in the hospital for another 2 or 3 weeks. The injury occurred when the Pope slipped getting out of the bath last night. It's the Pope's second accident in less than 6 months. In November, he dislocated his shoulder when he slipped and tumbled on the steps to his papal throne. There was speculation then that he may have been suffering from fainting fits, and the latest incident is likely to revive that. For National Public Radio, I'm Frances Kennedy in Rome.
Israeli officials say Syria has not been showing good faith in the Mideast peace negotiations. Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin met today with Secretary of State Warren Christopher in Tel Aviv, and officials say Rabin complained that Syria has not responded to Israel's latest concession. Rabin said last week Jewish settlements in the Golan Heights would have to be dismantled as part of the process of handing the region back to Syria. The Syrian president has not said anything since then in response. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Floyd Cochran, a former white supremacist. He was a national spokesperson and recruiter for the racist anti-Semitic group Aryan Nation. He lived in the group's Idaho compound from 1990 to 92. Since leaving the group, he's been speaking out against hate groups and trying to shed light on how they operate. Our interview was recorded last month. I remember I once interviewed a former Klansman who had gotten involved in politics.
Mm-hmm.
And when I asked him if he thought of himself as a racist, he said, well, no, you know, that he'd never really exactly been a racist and that the Klan isn't really a racist group. And I was wondering, like, when you were with Aryan Nation, if somebody, a reporter or anybody else said, are you a racist? How would you respond to that?
That I was a racialist. That I was proud of my heritage and culture and wanted to maintain it. And then I would move to another subject, not allowing the reporter the time to come up with another question or to think that one through.
No. Why couldn't you say, since it's so clearly a racist group, what would be the harm in admitting that you were racist?
Well, I think I did by saying I am a racialist.
You're avoiding. You're saying I have pride in my group as opposed to saying I hate other groups.
There are very few people in this country, who even if they are haters, want to publicly admit that they hate.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a human trait. Send him say, I hate. And again, that was one of the problems I had with the Aryans, in that I was more of a positive and they were negative. And racism doesn't thrive in a positive atmosphere for very long. But I was looking at angles of what can we do for the population, not what we are against. What would you gain by electing an Aryan Nation official? Not, this is what I'm against, but this is what I'm for. And again, it's just a simple switching of words.
So you'd never say, when you were with Aryan Nation, you'd never say to a reporter or to even a recruit that, yes, I'm a racist.
No, not point blank. Well, to recruit, yeah. And if I'm standing there in my uniform, it'd be very hard to...
to deny it.
Yeah. But again, there was... I found with reporters, the ones I worked with anyway, and partially it's because racism sells, was that as long as I said it with a friendly smile and didn't threaten them as a person, they would report exactly what I said, word for word. So it was up to me. Is how I looked at it. And I was, I believe, fairly successful. Yeah. I was in the paper all the time. I know that. And what is funny, as a racist, I could come into a town and I'd be on the front page of the newspaper or I'd be one of the top lead-in stories. Today I travel all over the country and it's page 3 and 4. Again, because racism sells newspapers, racism sells TV advertising and things like that.
You've described yourself as a self-taught racist.
Mm-hmm.
When did you start becoming a racist?
As a kid, I was always interested in history and politics.
Mm-hmm.
I remember at the age of 10, I read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, Inside the Third Reich.
And Hitler was a hero to you.
Yeah, I was very fascinated. I mean, here was this person that rose up from the gutter, the flags, the marches, the parades. I was very fascinated with that. That and coupled with what I was learning from society, from schools, from my parents, from foster homes, with really no one standing up and saying, no, that's wrong. I mean, this was in the 60s, 70s. An observation I would kind of like to point out. If you watch and read most of the things covering the young people in the racist movement today, you will see them all with a fascination for a uniform. Be it skinheads or the Klan or Aryan Nations or whatever, that fascination with some type of uniform.
Mm-hmm.
As an individual, I intellectually continue to grow. but on a very personal and emotional level, I stopped at about the age of 13. And when you think about it, that's the age when young boys are into being, you start that development of being macho and playing with, you know, the war games or the guns and being fascinated with Rambo type of things. But I saw numerous, just about everyone I ever met in the racist movement were, on an emotional level, were somewhere between the ages of 13 and 15.
You said you grew up in a lot of foster homes.
Mm-hmm. In upstate New York.
How did you end up in foster homes?
Yeah, my parents put me in one when I was 10.
Well,
it was a combination. It was my parents and the state.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was having problems. I was running away a lot. And schools said that I wasn't very bright. I didn't get along with family members. So at the age of 10, I went into a foster home. And for myself, in that regard, it was my brothers and sisters. They all got to live at home. I was the only one that went into a foster home. And that had a big whatever. Yeah.
Were you an angry kid?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing that my kid could do at the age of 10 that I would say, just here, you know, go away. The only time I ever saw my parents after that was for a funeral or a wedding. Yeah.
Since you grew up knowing very few blacks and Jews and not being close to them, where did your stereotypes come from? What made you...
Television. I grew up in a farming community, and the first thing that you hated in upstate New York is New York City.
Mm-hmm.
For a wide variety of reasons. And I would listen to people talk about all the welfare people in New York City, all the crime being committed, and every image I ever saw come across TV was a person of color. George Bush validated everything I ever thought about people of color with the Willie Horton ad. So it's stereotypes. I get asked numerous times by college people how racist groups perpetuate racial stereotypes. Society perpetuates the stereotypes. The racist groups simply feed off of it and press the buttons. You know, racism is just below the surface in our collective minds. It's just a matter of somebody presses the buttons.
My guest is Floyd Cochran, a former spokesperson and recruiter for the white supremacist group Aryan Nation. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Floyd Cochran, former national spokesperson for Aryan Nation, a white supremacist group. Now, you spent some time in prison. I think you were in and out.
9 months.
Oh, just 9 months?
Well, 9 months in, for one particular long stretch. I spent from 1976 to about 1989 in and out of jail, at least on the average of once a month.
For what kinds of charges?
Oh, everything from threatening to burn down a synagogue to not being able to get along with my wife to driving without a license, high-speed chases, writing bad checks, just being belligerent.
Now, here's something that really interests me. You're in and out of prison for abusing your wife, driving without a license, threatening to burn down a synagogue, and you think that it's the black people who are responsible for all the crimes when you're doing your share.
Right. The very few people want to accept responsibility and blame for the things that they do. I mean, think about it. I think one of the attractions of what I'm doing today is the ability to stand up and tell people that I apologize and that I was wrong. You know?
But this made sense to you at the time.
Oh, very, very much, very much. But nobody, very few people want to admit that they're wrong. I mean, it would be very easy for me to come on your show and say the way I turned out to be was not my fault. It was my parents' fault because I lived in a foster home.
Mm-hmm.
That was some of the contributing factors. But once I became an adult, I made my own choices, you know.
You've been out of Aryan Nation for only a year and a half.
2 years now.
Two years now. We'll
be in July.
Not a real long time.
No.
Are there still racist feelings that...
At times, yeah. A lot of fears and stereotypes.
Uh-huh.
The idea that somehow they go away in 48 hours is foolish. And if I try to tell you that, I'd be lying. I mean, I have days, there's times when I lay in bed at night thinking, am I doing the right thing? Did I violate God?
Did you violate God by leaving Aryan Nation?
Yeah, because of the Christian identity belief, mm-hmm. by giving up that belief system.
Do you have a belief system now? Or
in terms of religion,
system?
No.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No. I believe in God, but I don't have much to do with it organized.
Mm-hmm.
religion created by man.
You're obviously very smart. You've read a lot. A lot of what you read when you were younger was racist
garbage
diatribes. But you've read a lot. You've committed it to memory. You speak really well. You're smart.
Sometimes.
Well, here's what I'm wondering.
I spent 30 years not being very bright.
Right. But I'm wondering if when you were in school and you had a troubled childhood and you were in foster homes and in and out of prison and stuff, I wonder if like nobody, if you felt nobody recognized your intelligence until you became a member of Aryan Nation and you rose to the top and you had a leadership position and you were recognized there.
You ought to get yourself... That's exactly, but no one has ever said that before. Well, I'll take that back. Two nights ago when I spoke at Colgate University, but I told them, I said, you know, for me, one of the things that's most gratifying is the fact that here I am with no education, and I can come here and talk to your political science classes, your religious and race and ethnic studies classes, your communications classes. I meet with the smartest people you have on campus and realize that there isn't any difference between your intellect and mine, and that I am just as... That was exactly one of them, because I was constantly told as a young person by my parents, by foster homes, by psychologists, because I was a foster kid, that one, I would never amount to anything. Two, I wasn't very bright. I can remember they tried to put me into an alternative school because I wasn't very smart. I wasn't disciplined. I mean, I could sit down. I would, for instance, in from ninth grade until I got out of high school, I never took any notes. But they couldn't understand why I got 90s on test, because if I heard it, saw it, or watched it, it was there. I didn't do homework. I didn't, you know, but it was that discipline. But there was that feeling of somehow I was less than educated and somehow I was dumb. And I used to play that all the time when talking with reporters, you know. Well, I'm just a racist. What would you expect? I was invited to go and speak to colleges as a racist. And again, they weren't expecting much. That automatically gave me the advantage.
But this must have been one of the real appeals to you of actually remaining in our nation.
And picking up a newspaper and reading that I'm far more dangerous because I was educated and articulate. I was far more dangerous than the average Klansman because I was educated and articulate. That did all kinds of things. All kinds of things. And almost to the point of even driving me more, let's say.
You really knew how to play the media when you were spokesperson mm-hmm. with the Aryan Nation. And so, of course, you can imagine there's a part of me wondering now if you really know how to play me.
the only reason I a year and a half ago, I could understand that.
Uh-huh.
I think I've done a lot of things in the last year and a half that the only thing I can do is kind of... And I say that I've testified at Congresses.
About what?
Well, and I testified at the Montana State Senate to include sexual orientation in the malicious harassment law, the repeal mm-hmm. of the sodomy law.
Mm-hmm.
I've helped to program a skinhead here in Philadelphia. I've worked with umpteen law enforcement agencies, numerous. I go into high schools, I go into jails, I go into churches and synagogues. And in terms of getting paid or anything, the only place I get paid is colleges. Everything else comes out of, I use that college money to do all these other things. I also am writing materials that are sent out free of charge to people.
Do you face a lot of skepticism, or did
not
you?
Not so much now.
But early on.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because, well, what proof did I have?
Right.
You know, and the thing is, I'm not standing up and saying to people, I changed because I had a born-again experience.
Mm-hmm.
It would be so easy to do that.
Right.
To stand up and say, I've changed because I'm a Christian now. And people would, you know, I wouldn't have to really come up with any proof. And I know enough of the Bible that I could convince them. I wasn't under arrest, so I didn't have a jailhouse conversion. Oh, I was a rising star in the racist movement and walked off. You know, people don't understand that. That just isn't, you know, but people want proof. But I've built up a good, solid track record. In fact, we're getting ready to start an organization for parents whose children have become racist, because there's no place to turn. If you're 18 years old and want to leave the racist movement, where are you going to go? You're going to give up your friends and you're going to go live in a tent? No, not when you're 18. If your child gets involved with a racist group, where are you going to go as a parent? I work with hundreds of parents across the country who don't know what to do. I mean, they're totally devastated, distraught. They didn't raise their children to be Nazis. You know? They didn't raise their kid to become a skinhead, go join a group. cut off yourself from the rest of your family.
So what do you want to do with your life in the future now? I mean, it's just been a couple
Something
of years
positive.
Since you left. Uh-huh. Do you have, like, political or professional
no.
ambitions?
No. Someday I'll be milking cows again. You know, I say that. Well, I'd like to go to school, because if I have found out anything that, one, I can talk, and the other one is I like... It's a semblance of teaching when I come and speak to your class or your mm-hmm. communications class, where I'm fairly good at it.
Do you feel you have to protect yourself against people who might want to...
Kill me?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I've got a red Doberman. I've made a point of him and I being on some national TV shows. When I'm at home, I don't sleep too far from a gun. I brought somebody with me when I came here.
You know, I don't a bodyguard, somebody?
Well, not so much a bodyguard, but just to have somebody with me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting all kinds of numerous threats and so forth. So, you know, I've got to be careful in that regard. I mean, I'm only human. I don't let it get to me because the paranoia would drive me crazy.
Right.
You know, I try to make a joke out of it or something. But I'm sure the racists know where I live. I change my phone number about every 3 months, but I've had the same address. And I write articles on women in the hate groups, how hate groups recruit young people, things like that is mailed out, so that's pretty well known.
My guest is former white supremacist Floyd Cochran. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. I have a rundown of some of the stories coming up on All Things Considered. In the past 24 hours, 250,000 refugees have fled the violence in Rwanda. They're heading for neighboring Tanzania. United Nations officials say this is the single largest and fastest exodus they've ever witnessed. Michael Scholar reports on the last day of voting in South Africa. The vote count begins tomorrow. Kitty Feldy looks at Los Angeles 2 years after the riots. And Robert Siegel talks to a man who has spent the past 16 years of his life memorizing Homer's Iliad in Greek. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Back with Floyd Cochran, former spokesperson and recruiter for the white supremacist group Aryan Nation. I have another recruiting question. It seems to me that some of the people who'd want to join organized hate groups mm-hmm. would be kind of nuts. I mean, there probably some of the potential maybe
well, some, of them.
So some of the potential recruits or some of the recruits mm-hmm. might be a little on the psychotic side.
Oh, very much.
And out of your control after you recruited them.
Oh, very much. So, used to give me nightmares for several reasons. First of all, because I made myself an outcast by my choice
uh-huh,
from society,
uh-huh.
people who would be an outcast in most societies, be criminally minded or mentally whatever, those people need a place to hang out. So they go to the extremist parties, both left and right. It's not just something
yeah.
strictly a phenomenon of the extreme right. And those people, out of that feeling of wanting to do something, to prove themselves, of getting fired up because they are mentally unstable, would go out and commit a crime. And I would spend all this time, let's say, in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, working and building up a lot of credibility and stuff. And then somebody would go and who I had never seen before and would only stay for 2 weeks and go away would come along and throw a rock through the window or whatever. Or go downtown and attack a Jewish person or a black person or whatever. And everything I'd worked on would have been gone. So, yes, there are the psychotic. There.
What would you do with them? How would you handle them?
They would simply leave. Well, when I say leave...
You'd get rid of them.
Yeah. You take them downtown and say, here's a bus ticket, go away. Go join someone else or go do whatever it is you do.
I have one last question for you. Being mm-hmm. in any cult group or organized hate group...
Mm-hmm.
It gives you a sense of certainty. You know what you believe mm-hmm. in. You know what's right and mm-hmm. what's wrong. You know who the good people are and mm-hmm. who the evil people are mm-hmm. and how you're going to do away with evil.
Yeah.
You're out of that now, and it kind of leaves you in this more ambiguous world. Where
like a vacuum sometimes.
Yeah. So how have you been dealing with the ambiguity of not having this ideology that you can absolutely believe in?
Knowing that what I'm doing is right,
mm-hmm.
believing what I'm doing now is, mm-hmm. is right. I have times where I struggle with that. There are times a couple months ago of combination of a lot of the pressure and different things of wondering, am what I doing, is it making any good? Is it making any sense? Or am I just the little sideshow type of thing?
Mm-hmm. You know?
And so I received a bunch of letters from a bunch of high school kids from Pittsburgh who told me that some of the things I told them helped motivate them to fight against racism, or that it moved them or whatever. But yeah, I, like anyone else, have those days when I wonder, is it really all worth this kind of thing? Because it's more than just giving some talks. When I go and do these talks, well, again, I spoke at Colgate. The talk lasted 3.5 hours. I mean, I talked for an hour. The rest of the time was questions.
Right.
And when you answer questions from 200 people that run the gauntlet of everything from who I slept with to, let's talk about the most abstract idea in political science, it really, like, do I really need this? Because I don't have much of a, let's say, a personal life. It's hard to find. I'm divorced, so it's hard to find friends because they're afraid that someone's going to come kill me.
Right.
The other is, I'm very serious.
Yeah.
It's hard to find a date because of that, almost that same factor. First of all, the baggage is, I'm a racist. This guy must be, you know, he's going to beat me or do this, that, or whatever. But the other thing is, someone's going to come shoot you, kill you, or whatever. So in terms of having a personal life, I don't. This is my personal life of traveling and talking. It's very easy for me to talk to 300 people or 400 people or 800 people than it is to talk one-on-one. Two in one. Like, it's much easier for me and you to talk because this thing is sitting in front of us than
the microphone.
If
right.
Yeah.
I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you for having me here.
Floyd Cochran recorded last month. Cochran is a former spokesperson and recruiter for the white supremacist group Aryan Nation. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Nancy Greenlee, Sue Spolin, and Peter Clowney. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
When Gloria Steinem turned 40, she said, "This is what 40 looks like. We've been lying so long, who would know?" In her new book, Steinem reflects on turning 60. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Gloria Steinem about her new book, which also features essays on the politics of muscle and sex lies in advertising. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.